Hey everybody, my name is Sarah Crager. I am an emergency physician and intensivist at UCLA, and this is the ICU EDU podcast. Today we're going to talk about the big five, misses that matter. Your time in the emergency department is a zero-sum game. The more time you spend talking to patient A, the less time you have to talk to patient B. The more time you spend thinking about problem one, the less time you have to spend thinking about problem two. And it's not your job to know every single thing about every single patient every time. It's your job not to miss anything big. And if you try and take on the task of knowing everything about everybody all the time, not only is it just not possible, more importantly, attempting to do that means you're much more likely to miss the big things. Now, when I say misses that matter, I'm not talking about the needle in the haystack game that we play in the ED all the time, where we try and figure out which of the million patients with a headache actually has a subarachnoid, or which of the million patients with a fever actually has an epidural abscess. That's not what I'm talking about. That's a different game. That's the needle in the haystack game. I'm talking about in a sick patient. How do you decide to invest both your time and, more importantly, your mental energy, your focus? Because sick doesn't always equal complicated. For example, a patient with a STEMI is sick, but that patient doesn't actually necessarily need a lot of your time or a lot of your mental energy. Why? Because they're sick in a straightforward way. You know exactly what they have and you know exactly what to do. And your action items are pretty straightforward, and it's more a matter of just navigating the system in a way than actually really thinking carefully about what's going on. Why are they sick? Is there something more subtle here? Now, figuring out the in a sick patient who's straightforward and who's not, that takes judgment, that takes gestalt, and it takes experience. So I want to talk a little bit about, to me, the big five, the things where missing it in a patient, in a sick patient, actually causes them problems down the line. Because I don't think that I had the best perspective on this when I'm in the ED. I actually think what gave me the best perspective on this was taking care of the patients in the ICU, was when I was on the receiving end of that admission and, you know, realizing that there's a bunch of stuff that it's not my job to catch when I'm in the ED. It's my job to catch it later when I'm in the ICU. But then there's things where if we miss it in the ED, I discovered missing these things can really have a significant effect on how the patient does after that, on how the patient does during the hospital course can really affect their outcome. So this is my big five, because this is where it matters. These are the misses that matter to me, where we should be investing our time and energy, because if we miss these things in the acute phase, it can cause the patient problem later. Thing number one, lactate doesn't necessarily mean sepsis. Thing number two, shock is not about hypotension. Thing number three, dyspnea doesn't necessarily mean a lung problem. Thing number four, fluids is not a cure-all for hypotension. And thing number five, seeing good LV systolic function on a bedside echo doesn't tell you the heart's not the problem. Let's go through one by one now. Number one, lactate does not necessarily mean sepsis. So this is one of my all-time pet peeves, and I could go and rant about lactate for a really long time, and I'm going to not rant about it too much right now, because the key point is lactate can reflect any kind of shock. An elevated lactate could mean that the patient's in septic shock, or it could also mean that the patient's in cardiogenic shock or hemorrhagic shock or any other kind of shock. Now, lactate actually doesn't even necessarily mean that the patient's in shock at all, right? I mean, we've all seen, for example, a patient in status epilepticus. They come in, they have a high lactate, and, you know, then we recheck it an hour later and it's cleared because that lactate was not actually telling you the patient was in shock. And when I think about lactate, I think about really there's two categories. There's your stress hyperlactemia. Because it turns out there's a whole pathway that can give you an elevated lactate that has nothing to do with tissue hypoperfusion at all. And that's basically when you have a bunch of beta adrenergic stimulation. Now, it doesn't matter if that's exogenous stimulation, like if you give somebody a bunch of epinephrine, if you give them a bunch of albuterol, or commonly, if the patient comes in after doing a bunch of meth or cocaine, sometimes you'll see this. And so that can be causing a high lactate sometimes, but endogenous beta adrenergic stimulation, or when a patient is in a state of high physiologic stress. And that part's important because you can often see that in early shock. And I personally think that lactate elevations, especially in early shock, has a lot more to do with physiologic stress causing a hyperlactemia than it does with tissue hypoperfusion. But regardless, even to the extent that which your high lactate reflects one or the other, whether it reflects physiologic stress or it reflects tissue hypoperfusion, it doesn't tell you why you have either physiologic stress or tissue hypoperfusion. And so again, you can get a high lactate in any cause of stress or tissue hypoperfusion. It's not just sepsis. And if we see a high lactate and think that automatically means sepsis, we can make huge errors, both in terms of giving patients treatments that are going to hurt the real cause of their shock. So we give them 3 liters of fluid and it turns out they have RV failure and pulmonary hypertension. But it can also, if you're just like, oh, they have a lactate, it must be sepsis, can cause you to not work up and chase whatever might really be causing their shock. So, number one, lactate doesn't necessarily mean sepsis. Thing number two, shock and hypotension. So we have this idea that if the patient is not hypotensive, they can't possibly be in shock. And is blood pressure an extremely important data point in shock? Yes, very much so, 100%. But it's not the only data point. And a normotensive patient can be in shock, especially when you think about the fact that early compensated shock is a state of physiologic stress. Now, what happens when people are physiologically stressed? Well, when physiologic stress happens, people get tachycardic, tachypneic, and hypertensive, right? We see all these trauma patients who come in, and they're tachycardic, and often at first, especially our young, healthy trauma patients, they're hypertensive. Why? Because that's what the body does in a state of early physiologic stress. And in fact, that hypertensive stress response can mask the underlying hypotension. So shock and hypotension are not the same thing. And especially because in the early phases of shock, you could just be masking it. If you wait until they're hypotensive, if you wait that long to diagnose shock, you're missing a lot of the early phase of shock, and you're missing that golden period when your interventions may be the most effective. Now, there's no one data point, because your question next is probably like, okay, well, if I just can't diagnose shock by just waiting till they're hypotensive, what do I do? I mean, lactate? So, you know, lactate's also a very helpful data point, but it's not the only one, because you can't rule shock in or out by the presence or absence of lactate. Really, at the end of the day, blood pressure and lactate are important data points, but when you're looking for shock, you need to be looking for evidence of physiologic stress and tissue hypoperfusion in lots of different places. In addition to their blood pressure and their lactate, you should be looking at the patient themselves. What's their mental status like, right? Are they agitated, as people often get in a state of physiologic stress, or are they just out and they're just barely conscious? Are they diaphoretic, as again, you get in a state of physiologic stress, or are they now mottled because they're profoundly hypoperfused? What's their urine output? Is it low? Look at their extremities. How's their cap refill? What does the SpO2 waveform look like, not just the number? And then you can look at your other labs, because in addition to a lactate, you have a base excess and a bicarb. And then you can look for evidence of end organ dysfunction. What's their creatinine? What are their liver function tests? Do they have a little trope leak or a little BNP? Do you see evidence that their end organs are starting to suffer? So, shock is not just about hypotension. Blood pressure is an important point, but it's not the only one. You need to take a multi-point assessment of whether your patient's in shock. Number three, dyspnea does not necessarily mean a lung problem. Now, this is what I call the dyspnea masquerade. Because it turns out that yes, certain lung problems can absolutely cause your patient to have dyspnea, for sure. But just because your patient has a lung problem doesn't necessarily mean they'll always present with dyspnea, right? I mean, this was what we saw with COVID. We'd have patients who definitely had a lung problem, and they'd come in and they'd be sitting 70 and they'd be like, I think I'm fine. Okay. But the other direction, I would say, is more important, because there are a bunch of things other than a lung problem that can cause your patient to have the sensation of dyspnea. Most importantly, in sick patients, acidemia, and tissue hypoperfusion can cause your patient to feel like they can't breathe. Because when patients are acidemic, there's this very cleverly rigged system that says, okay, in order to compensate, you need to breathe faster to blow off the CO2 to try and return the pH to normal. So the respiratory centers get stimulated and the patient feels they can't breathe. We see this in DKA all the time, right? The patient won't come in and say, I have DKA. They'll come in and say, I can't breathe. In addition, patients in shock, right? So a patient in any kind of shock often feels like they can't breathe because their tissues are like, hello, we're not getting enough oxygen. Can you please give us more? And the patient has the sensation they can't breathe. Now, this becomes important. Why? Because if we think that a patient who's dyspneic, and not just having the sensation of dyspnea, but truly they're really tachypneic and they're working hard to breathe, if we think that must mean they have a lung problem, then one, we end up chasing the lung problem and failing to explore, might they be in shock? Why might they have such a bad acidemia? And so we might miss the real thing going on with them. But the other thing that we are then prone to do is intubate them. And this is where you can really start having problems. Because if you take a patient who has, say, profound metabolic acidosis, or a patient who, let's say, is in profound cardiogenic shock, or really any kind of shock, and that's what's driving their dyspnea, intubating them can be really detrimental and cause them to crash and burn. And the physiologically difficult airway, that happens all the time, right? Whether we know it or not. And so, you know, physiologically difficult airways are hard to deal with, but what we really don't want to do is accidentally put ourselves in that situation when we thought we had to intubate because we were treating a lung problem, whereas in reality, the better thing to do probably wouldn't be intubating the patient at all, because intubation doesn't solve acidemia and it doesn't solve shock. That's number three. Number four, fluids are not a cure-all for nonspecific hypotension. It's really easy when a nurse calls us to tell us that the patient is hypotensive to just say, give a liter and call me back. That's really easy for multiple reasons. It's a really reflex response that I have as well. Why? Because it's easy. You know, you can just give a liter. I don't have to think about it. I don't have to put in a special line. I don't have to think about, oh, if I start giving them fluids, I'll have to admit them to a different level of care. Our system is set up so that it's easy. It incentivizes us just to reflexively give fluids for hypotension. Now, this is a problem because not only is it that fluids may not help the reason they're hypotensive, it could in fact hurt the patient. Because fluids will only help if the reason that the patient is hypotensive will be improved by fluids. Now, if the patient is, you know, profoundly hypovolemic, then 100% that'll help you. If the patient is vasodilated, it'll help you transiently, certainly. But if the patient has a massive PE, if they're in cardiogenic shock, that really, really won't help you. If it turns out they just massively bled into their belly and you now give them 2 liters of cold normal saline, that's not going to help you either. But I will say that the problem I often see isn't like the single empiric fluid bolus while you're trying to figure out the problem. The problem I often see is just give 1 more liter and recheck the BP. Then they recheck it and call you back. Well, just give 1 more liter and recheck the BP. And then by the time I end up getting involved, because now I get the call, well, we, you know, now have given the patient 4 liters of fluid and they're still hypotensive. And now we're really in trouble. And so fluids, not a cure-all for hypotension. And especially if you're doing something and it doesn't work, don't keep doing that thing. Go and investigate, why isn't this working? All right. Last, number five. Good LV systolic function doesn't necessarily tell you you're not dealing with a heart problem. Apologies for the double negative there. So, you know, while we're trying to figure out what's going on with the patient, especially, you know, I gave a fluid bolus, do I give another one? Or is my patient, you know, it's a dyspnea problem, but is it, you know, really shock? Is it something else? We often ultrasound the patient, as we should. We use ultrasound as a really critical tool to figure out what's wrong with the patient. What's the number one thing we do when we're doing that? We look at the LV. We look at the left ventricle systolic function. And then very commonly, and I am 100% guilty of this myself, if the left ventricular systolic function looks good, then we conclude that the heart is not the primary problem. I've done it. We've all done it because it's just easy. You're like, oh, good squeeze. Fantastic. It's not the heart. Let me figure out what else is going on, but it's not the heart. Now, increasingly in general, It's being recognized in the cardiology and ED universes that LV systolic function is not the only thing. Right? Like conceptually, now we start talking about HFrEF versus HFpEF, right? Heart failure with reduced ejection fraction versus heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. But I think there's a couple situations specifically that we need to think about. Because just because the LV looks good doesn't mean you don't have other problems. Now, if it's you have a huge pericardial effusion, we're not going to miss that. But I think the other things to think about are, just because the LV systolic function looks good, they could still have substantial diastolic function. They could still have bad RV failure, or they could have a big valvular abnormality. And some of us have good enough ultrasound skills to assess those things, but a lot of us don't, and I don't necessarily have good enough ultrasound skills to assess all those things. So just being thoughtful in realizing that they may still have a heart problem just because their systolic function looks okay. Now, conversely, if the LV systolic function doesn't look good, you can't conclude that the heart is the problem. Because if that's the patient's baseline, let's say you have a patient with bad HFrEF, with, you know, bad heart failure with a reduced ejection fraction, that patient is totally allowed to have hypovolemic shock. They're totally allowed to have distributive shock. And so if we look at the heart and the LV looks, oh, their EF is maybe 35%, that doesn't mean the heart is the problem. They may still need fluids. So there's more to echo than just looking at the LV, and either get better echo skills than I have probably, or learn to sort of think differently about it so that you can go beyond just looking at the LV and ask the question, get a formal echo, or figure out other ways to try and identify some of those other things like diastolic dysfunction, RV failure, and valvular abnormalities. This is another one that I'm going to find one of my ultrasound colleagues to have a talk about, because I think there's some pearls of wisdom to share how you can think about and easily work up things that are not just LV systolic function for those of us that are not excellent at ultrasound. So that is the big five, the misses in sick patients that matter. Lactate doesn't always equal sepsis. Shock is not about hypotension. Dyspnea doesn't necessarily mean a lung problem. Fluids are not the cure-all for hypotension. And good LV systolic function doesn't tell you the heart's not the problem necessarily. Those are the big five things that I think are complicated to think about. They're not straightforward, but they're misses that matter. So I think they deserve our time and mental energy in that zero-sum game calculation. Thanks for listening.